About 7 years ago, writer David Harden was coping with his elderly mother's illness. He and his mom had a pretty complicated relationship, and he wasn't sure if he'd made peace with their lifelong cycles of need and alienation. At the same time, Harden, an award-winning poet who lives in Oakland County, was becoming aware of what was going on in Flint as the water crisis was exploding across the front pages and into the national consciousness. David Harden subsequently went to Flint as a Red Cross volunteer to deliver water. And his reflections during that period, marrying the desolation with his mother's death with the public devastation in Flint, come together in his new memoir called Standpipe. David Harden, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. I'm really happy to be here.
So the book is about this trip that you took to Flint as you were sort of thinking on and processing your mother's illness and death and the relationship that you two had in her lifetime. How would you describe your relationship with your mom?
I won't say it was difficult, and I won't even say it was complicated. We lived apart for many years. She was from Tennessee. She moved to Michigan with my father. They lived here for many years, and then she moved back to her hometown after my father passed away. So I didn't see her a lot for a good 15 years, but we weren't very close. We were superficially close, but it always felt to me like there was some a wide gulf between us that we could never quite bridge.
You two were very close when you were small, I think as a lot of us are with our parents.
Yeah.
Where had you two gotten to by the time she was closing in on the end of her life?
Well, we had come full circle. I mentioned it in the book, but it suddenly dawned on me. It hit me like a ton of bricks, actually. I realized that I really needed her. And at the time, I was in my late 50s, and she was in her 80s. And again, we had been apart for a long time. But it really struck me when she became ill and started to deteriorate. I realized that I really needed her and badly wanted to be with her and to try. I guess I didn't understand it at the time, but I really wanted to try to bridge that gulf between us.
This was all spooling out at the time when the Flint water crisis was unfolding publicly.
Yes.
Which I just want to make a little delineation there between what was happening in the Flint water crisis and when most of the world found out about it. And there were many, many people watching TV and hearing the updates and just feeling helpless, not knowing what to do.
Yes.
What made you, at the time you were in this intense emotional space about your mother, what made you decide to volunteer for the Red Cross to deliver water in Flint?
She died in September of 2015, and I had been listening to the reports off and on, but I, to be honest, I wasn't completely focused on them. I was really dealing with her death, her impending death. Then once she was gone, I happened to be home recovering from some surgery that wouldn't allow me to walk. I was immobile for a while. So I was listening to the radio a lot. I was listening to Michigan radio a lot. And the reports were really, there was an onslaught of reports every day about what was happening in Flint. It was just really emerging. And what really enraged me were the reports about the children. They had been drinking lead-tainted water for months and months and months. And that, in particular, mobilized me. And as soon as I could walk and drive my car again, I just literally got in the car one day and drove to Flint. I live in Royal Oak, and it's about a 70-mile drive. And I just went there. I didn't have a plan in mind. I knew I wanted to do something productive.
There's a very short prelude at the beginning of the book that kind of sets the tone for what we're about to experience. Could you read it for us?
I'd be happy to. Have a blessed day, I'm told over and over again. I've never felt so blessed. Kindness bestowed by people too bereft of surplus to warrant such generosity. I'm grateful, but my gratitude is leavened with a liberal dash of liberal guilt. I wince despite myself every time I hear it uttered. Repetition dulls the sting. Liberated by banality, I mourn the loss.
I know a lot of people in Flint were profoundly aware of a wider world and a wider white world waking up to what was going on with them. Maybe there's something there that at least part of that feeling was reciprocated from folks who were coming to help. But, you know, a lot of people did have feelings like this, but not a lot of people actually went and did something in the physical world about it. I know what you're saying about feeling mobilized about the kids, but is there any other light you can shed on what led you to go and make this commitment?
Yeah, I grew up in the Detroit area in the late 50s, early 60s, and I came from a family from the South, and they arrived here with some inherent biases. And those biases are my biases, and I've spent my life trying to overcome them. And when I went to Flint, I arrived with certain assumptions, and one of them was that I was, I have progressive attitudes, I have racial equanimity, but I was really fearful upon reflection of having those tested, of having that sense of equanimity tested. But part of my reasoning for going, I think, was to try to undo some of those early biases that I absorbed growing up in a house where I grew up.
And generally speaking, what did you find when you got to Flint? How did people react to you as you would show up at their door with cases of water?
Well, you know, it was an odd situation. Normally, when you're a Red Cross disaster relief volunteer, you're responding to a natural disaster in a city or out in the country, and you're delivering food and water to people, and they tend to come to you. The city, their whole blocks are devastated. They tend to come to you and you hand out the help. But in Flint, it was reversed. Our job, my job, was to deliver water to people who couldn't drive or didn't have the means to drive to one of the state-funded delivery sites. So, you know, we were knocking on doors and going into houses every day. And I can say without reservation, everybody was incredibly welcoming and friendly. People wanted to talk. It became a problem sometimes. You know, we really had to keep things moving to make sure we delivered, you know, all the water that we had to deliver that day. But it was really hard sometimes not to spend time just chatting with people and hearing their story. That became important to me.
It sounds like you had done some Red Cross work before.
No, I hadn't. I did very little research. I managed to find out that the Red Cross was the only portal to really volunteering in Flint officially. So that's where I went on my first day. When I drove to Flint, I went right to the Red Cross and went through a process and became a certified disaster relief volunteer, which allowed me to drive an emergency relief vehicle. They call it an ERV. People have seen them. They're the red and white boxy trucks that you see in disasters, you know, parked, handing out food and water.
The book is structured as vignettes, almost like a diary, interlayered with stories about your mom and sometimes your dad and your own childhood. It kind of leaves me with the impression that your mom was, even though you were doing this work that was certainly consuming and important and as you say, pretty interesting too, it seems like your mom was on your mind a lot in those days.
She was, as well as my father. I don't know that I can even explain it to this day, but going to Flint and spending the time that I spent there allowed me to start to look at some things about my family that I don't think I had really wanted to look at before I arrived. And it had a lot to do with her death, and I was in the middle of grieving. But also just grieving the relationship that the three of us had growing up. Maybe it's a function of age, too, but the vignette aspect of the book is a product of the way I started to write it. I was taking notes and wanting to preserve my memories, and I never set out to write a book. And before long, I realized I had quite a large volume of work, and I sent it to a local poet, Thomas Litch, who I'm acquainted with, and he read it, and he thought it was okay, but he really thought it needed a catalyst, a parallel story to set it off and really create some tension. And so I took his advice.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Royal Oak-based poet David Hardin. His recent memoir is called Standpipe, and it weaves together municipal and family trauma. I'd like to ask you to read again from the book. This is one of the later chapters that touches on both what was going on in Flint and also what was going on with you. Do you want to set it up?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. In 2015, the crisis had been evolving in Flint, and it was certainly not new to the people who lived there, but it was only beginning to emerge within the outside world. And I was, my mother really had taken a turn for the worst. And again, I was living in Royal Oak and going back and forth to Tennessee to try to attend to her. And her birthday was coming up, and the family gathered there together to celebrate her birthday. She was in a nursing home at the time. So I'll go ahead and read this. Disaster is officially declared in Flint. It is 2015, well over a year since unsuspecting residents were first exposed to toxic levels of lead and biohazardous effluents. Tractor trailers full of donated bottled water arrive daily from points north, south, east, and west. Flint is world news, a symbol of the fraying fabric of American civic responsibilities and the nation's decaying infrastructure. Even Cher dispatches a semi or two. Residents are urged not to drink or bathe in unfiltered tap. The state provides filters for standard kitchen faucets, but not for tub or shower fixtures. Rumors abound that shower filters are available to the well-connected. Physicians treat patients for lead toxicity, rashes, and Legionella bacterial infection. Water for drinking, cooking, and bathing. For pets, medical care, teeth brushing, and ice comes in 16-ounce bottles that end up filling thousands of recycling bags or accumulating in great glittering heaps in backyards and vacant lots. I hear the reports, make a mental note to investigate further, but fail to register the magnitude of the disaster. Truth is, I'm barely listening. We've planned a family reunion in Tennessee to celebrate Imanel's upcoming birthday. She survived surgery, most of her small intestine removed, wheelchair-bound, alive, but greatly diminished. She's living in a nursing home 3 miles equidistant from the small farm where she grew up and her old condo. My brother and I have spent months driving back and forth arranging for her care, battling bureaucracy, tracking the decaying orbit of her life. She steadfastly refuses to rejoin us in Michigan. She seems to be losing her grip on reality, but outwardly remains optimistic and accepting of her circumstances. We haul in pizza, ice cream, and cake, enough for 20. But it's a Saturday, only a weekend skeleton crew on duty, essential personnel only. A couple of aides and a harried nurse wander through the common room. They politely decline cake, eye the pizza noncommittally. Group pictures are taken, old jokes rehashed, ribbing of the good-natured variety flows. We box leftovers, stash everything in the staff refrigerator, all of us due to fly out the following day. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear mother. Happy birthday to you. She'll be dead in a few weeks, one day shy of her 83rd birthday.
Thank you for reading that.
You're welcome.
What do you think it was about the journey to Flint that helped you sort out your thoughts about your mom and the end of her life? Was it just getting the perspective of something so much larger than one family, or just having the time while you were outside of your normal routine?
That's a great way to put it. It really got me out of my head. I was partly because I was grieving, partly because I was quarantined at home back at that time, kind of echoing the quarantine we're all doing now. I needed something to wake me up and get me out of my own funk, and meeting people every time I was there and talking to them and finding out about their lives and about just what a struggle it is to live in Flint every day, even without a water crisis, allowed me to get beyond my own petty concerns.
I get a sense reading the book that maybe in the moment it felt easier for you to contemplate what was going on in Flint than to contemplate the problems that your mom had at the end of her life. I mean, her illness doesn't even really manifest until quite a few chapters into the book.
Well, that's it. And maybe I wasn't ready to deal with it. And Flint offered me a diversion. And that's a valid point. But I think if I hadn't of volunteered in Flint and hadn't had that experience, I'm not sure that I would have been prepared as soon as I was to really delve into the relationship we had. And things really didn't resolve it with her death. She died. We really never had any kind of reconciliation, one that I expected. Maybe I thought it was due me, but it doesn't always happen that way.
Why do you think it didn't happen?
Good question. And I'm not sure I can answer it in the time we have. But the short answer is that my mother and I both had to reach accommodation with my father. And in order to do that, we had to almost disavow the connection that we had early on. And we never were able to come back together and recover from that.
Could you say more about what you mean by that? That each of you couldn't step away from the relationships you had with him, so that made it impossible to have a relationship with each other?
Yeah, he was a man who struggled, I think, himself with his own emotions, and he really struggled with intimacy, and she had to accommodate that in her own life to such a degree that I wonder sometimes if it how that affected her ability to really relate to me, and vice versa. I had to make accommodations for him as well. Whether right or wrong, I think it prevented my mother and I from really maintaining a deep and evolving relationship as the years went by. And maybe I'm not explaining it in a sensical way, but maybe for now that's the best I can do.
David Harden's new memoir is called Standpipe, Delivering Water in Flint, available on Belt Publishing. David, thank you very much for talking with us about this.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for being interested in the book. I appreciate it.